you. So my name is Colin Keir. I am from Vancouver, as someone else is too. So just like 2.5 million other people, we managed to survive the Olympics. Here's a little question. How many of you actually ever been to an Olympic event before? Raise your hand. And I can't see anymore. Just scream. No. Oh, there we go. So, yeah, back in 2003, Vancouver hosted, won the right to host the Olympics, and in 2010, we hosted the Winter Olympics. So, the topic is called Brilliance Exploits, the Vancouver 2010 Olympics. My whole goal with this topic is basically to discuss the social issues and the technological, I would say, maybe problems or observations that were made by a bunch of us here in Vancouver. So, there's no brilliance exploits involved in this event. Actually, it's a rather unfortunate title. So the slogan for the Olympics was "With glowing hearts" or "Deplete brilliant exploits," and I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. Forgive my high school French, but basically, it's just an excerpt from the Canadian national anthem, and basically that kind of goes into a little topic about copyright, which I'll explain a little bit later. And one little unfortunate item that came up during the Olympics when I was at a curling match was something called hack radio. If any of you are familiar with curling, probably knows what the term hack means. For the life of me, I can't remember now because I'm on this stage. So, go figure. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring across 5 points. So, I'm going to talk about how the city becomes locked down, how the police interact with the people, and that sort of thing, and I'll probably use the protests as a good example of what happened, but I also discuss other things that came up. And also look at Olympic branding and copyright and how they all relate. Then I'll look at security in terms of ticket sales and so forth. So and it's kind of the same topic here. And then we're going to talk about, lastly, is how we thought we might have been able to get into the CCTV network and what we actually ended up finding out about in the end. So without further ado, I'm going to go into the first part of the topic, and that is the security. So if you put this in perspective on how ridiculous security was at the 2010 Olympics, Salt Lake City, which was only a few months after 9/11, spent a total of $200 million, roughly around there, on just security. And that included, you know, things like having the military, I think it was like the, I guess you guys can't have the military, but I guess the National Guard handling certain events, and of course, having your police and so forth. In the case of 2010 Olympics, the Canadian government, along with the provincial government, managed to spend almost $1 billion on security. And I don't know where the money went to, because when I explain ticket sales, it's kind of baffling. But as you can see here, you go to a typical event, and you would have yourself screened as if you were going to fly an airplane, because you apparently are going to be bringing knives into the stadium. This is me waiting in line to go into a curling event. And so basically, yeah, it looked pretty much just like going into an airport, except there's no planes around there. And they also had open fields with Doppler radar. Now, I don't understand why they had Doppler radar in the middle of a curling rink when there's nothing going on inside that requires good weather. But as you can see here, it's on an open field. So my presumption is that they were using it somehow to keep to make sure that nobody's wandering in. I don't know Doppler radar enough to actually explain that, so somebody could potentially tell me that afterward. And, of course, they were very paranoid to think that people would bring boats into near the Olympic Village. They also had scuba divers swimming around the waters around the Olympic sites. And just as general absurdity, they even had, actually go back here, I wish that was actually another order. There we go. They also had, like, you know, I think this is a frigate here actually floating around Barley Inlet. The thing that makes me weird, curious about this is, why would you have a large ship trying to control people or terrorists? It's just one of those silly things. And of course, you had police with, you know, SWAT teams roaming around and so forth. And to make this even more absurd, they brought in police officers from all over the country to handle security during the event. So they also had private security, but they also brought in outside police. And what was really silly about it was that they also brought corrections officers to actually handle some of the Olympic sites. Now, knowing the police and how they know their rights and so forth, it's a little bit weird to have corrections officers who handle prisoners patrolling the streets. So it's one of those silly things that I observed as I was wandering around. And of course, there was this whole level of paranoia prior to the Olympics where This is where the transit police brought out these ads. You know, if you see people taking pictures of cameras, that you should call the police. Now, I don't know what sort of thing that some terrorist, quote unquote, would actually do with a picture of a camera, but you know, what do I know? I'm not a police officer. So, with all this security paranoia from the police and the government, there was this worryment that was going around that, you know, rights were going to be circumvented. And as you can see in this photo here, here's one of the Olympic mascots. Can't remember his name. I think it's Sumi. Can't remember. Whatever. There's a whole bunch of mascots. I'll bring up something a little bit later about them. Basically, from everything you could see here, a lot of rights are being trampled. There were lots of laws introduced, such as the Homelessness Initiative Act, which basically, if you're found homeless on the streets, the police could pick you up and force you to go into a shelter or even supposedly jail. And it was actually really serious because up until then, the homeless were kind of not so much, but really left alone. But as the Olympics drew closer, a lot of these things became prevalent and some sort of quote-unquote issue all of a sudden. So we had that. And there was another initiative that came out, whereas if you were to have a sign on your own property that would basically be something anti-Olympic or something that didn't really jive with the IOC or the Vancouver Olympic Committee or VANOC, excuse me, you could be either arrested or you could be arrested and put in jail for up to 3 months or even still be fined something like a couple $1,000s just for having a sign on your lawn. Now, the provincial government allowed the Vancouver Council to actually amend the bylaw to actually amend their constitution, their city charter, excuse me, to permit the sea sort of rules. But as far as I know, it was never actually enacted, fortunately. But, you know, things like this were passing, and this is sort of the whole kind of nature that was going on here. So you have to excuse me here. There's no water on the stage here. No, I got one here. Sorry. Sorry, I'm not used to the humidity in this city, so I've been kind of tired. So, as you can see, here's a little poster from one of the anti-Olympic groups that were put out. You can see here the attitude from the people against this sort of action was pretty clear. And Take Back Our City was actually one of the events that was organized and was actually supposed to coincide with the opening ceremonies. So you can see here the three main Olympic mascots were there, and they all got together and actually protested. Now, so about 3,000 to 5,000 people converged not too far from where the Olympics are. If you look in the back towards the left, there's actually the Paralympic countdown. The other side was the Olympic countdown. So this, they actually put this clock up here, and it was always a constant target for people to actually deface. And now it just reads 0, 0, 0, just constant zeros and doing nothing. But yeah, basically there was a ton of people that organized actually outside of what's known as the Vancouver Art Gallery, and it's actually common to actually organize protests there. So one of the things that the BC Civil Liberties Association did, because they were fearful of what the police were going to do, is they brought in these legal observers. And the objective that these people had was effectively to ensure that the rights and privileges that you have with the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms were kept in line. Police were keeping themselves in line. And while there was a lot of controversy between the protesters and BCCLA afterward, overall, from this protest, nothing major actually happened. And you can see here, people are marching towards BC Place Stadium, which is where the Olympic ceremonies were held. And, of course, they eventually met with the police. Now, these are mostly RCMP and Vancouver police officers, and even though it kind of looks like they're pushing on the protesters there, from everything I've read from the front lines, nothing actually happened. The police were cordial, and the protesters never really got out of line, per se. This goes in stark contrast to the G8, G20 protests, whereas if you were 5 meters away from them, you would be arrested. So big difference there, and it's kind of silly. And, of course, you can see they were not that far away from the actual stadium. Let's go skip to the next day, where 200 people decided to march downtown. And if you're Canadian, you're familiar with the term Black Bloc. I don't know if it's the term used in the United States, but these Black Bloc protesters basically were involved in this here, and they were made deemed basically demonized later by the media. And, you know, they all protested through the city and so forth by throwing newspaper boxes and mailboxes across the street. Really, not much more than being a nuisance more than anything. But then it turned to, actually skip here, then it turned to crap, excuse me, here, by throwing stuff in the windows. This is the worst thing that happened, really. There was nothing worse than this. There was some glass broken and some stuff spray painted. The worst, you know, this was the Bay, one of the largest companies sponsoring the Olympics within the country itself, and all they did was smash windows. So that was the worst thing. So where did the $1 billion of security actually go to, you'll have to wonder. Well, I'll take a look at that in a second here. So after the glass was smashed, the police came in and donned the riot gear, and you can see here the protesters are backing away at this point. Brought out their machine gun. Sorry, is that a semi-automatic? Does anyone know what that gun is? Okay, so you can see here they brought out the heavy artillery at this point. They're probably shooting rubber bullets, I hope. The protest got really deep into what's known as the West End. It's mostly residential, but it was also the site of the Olympic Family Hotel, which is in the background, as you can see here. And the police were more concerned about just keeping it away from there. This one person's, of course, getting arrested. Out of all the 200 people, I think only a couple dozen, if that, got arrested, and it might even be less than that from what I remember. I like this photo most because he's wearing Canada boxers, so I don't know why I like that photo a lot, but I did. And as they videotaped everyone else took photos of them, so I figure it's tit for tat. Now, how many of you are hockey fans? How many of you are Rangers fans? Okay, so about 16 years ago, there was a certain team from a certain city that I might have mentioned earlier playing against a certain team from a certain city that plays in a stadium that may or may not be across the street from here. And it went all the way to Game 7, and that certain team that I was very fond of at a very young age lost. It was sad. And, of course, one little thing happened in that city that I'm talking about. A riot. About, the numbers are always varied in what happened here, but about anywhere between 10 and 60,000 people converged on downtown Vancouver. Most of them were drunk after getting to Game 7, and the largest riot in Vancouver's history after whatever that other riot that I can't remember off the top of my head, basically erupted, tear gas everywhere. If you ever go on YouTube, just do search for Vancouver 1994 Stanley Cup riots, and you'll see how bad of a situation it is. Let's skip to the Olympics. How many people were downtown for the games to watch them? Well, there was, on average, it was estimated anywhere between 100 to 200,000 people or anywhere in a downtown core at any given time during the two-week event. And, you know, everyone's being all patriotic and happy. And the one thing that was I kind of feared and kind of expected or to happen was that Canada and the United States would end up in a gold medal hockey game. And they did. On Canadian soil. So the worryment that I had was that we would have a repeat of 94 if we lost. Now, I don't know if we won if the same thing would have happened either, but it didn't. But in the end, the Canadian team did win over the Americans in overtime, fortunately. But, not to rub in your guys' faces or anything, but I'm just saying. But basically, that was my main thought about what was ignored by the media in terms of what the security costs were going towards. And it was actually going towards to prevent things like the 1994 Stanley Cup riots from, you know, rearing their ugly heads again. But a lot of things actually were done prior to doing that. So they actually stopped liquor sales past 10 p.m. and so forth, or past 6 p.m., excuse me. Just to prevent the consumption of liquor in the open, because it's actually illegal, just like most of North America, to drink liquor in the open, unless you're in Nevada or Mexico, I guess. So that was the main concern. But I don't know, see how $1 billion was needed to stop that when really it just really seems absurd. So that gives you an idea of what the climate was like in terms of the policing and so forth. And I'm going to go back to the security element in a little bit later, actually, here when I talk about how tickets were handled and passes for staff were handled. So I'm going to talk about advertising and Olympic branding. So the IOC is very, very protective about their brand. Now, case in point, there was a pizza place or a Greek place, I can't remember where it, what it serves, called Olympia in the western end of the downtown Vancouver core. And they actually have the Olympic rings actually on their logo. Now, other companies have had their Olympic rings actually stored in the logo as well. And the IOC has managed to force anyone who misuses the brand, the Olympic rings brand, to remove it from their signs. So an international organization has been going to any host country, for that matter, to actually have these logos removed. But the main reason for that is not because they want to make sure that the sanctity of the Olympic rings are kept, because we all know how figure skating works. It more or less has to do with how much money these companies put into Olympic advertising, and it's a lot. As you can see here, this is one of the towers in the downtown core, and Samsung put their crappy Omniaphone actually on the tower. Now, this is not the only ad that was on a tower. There's like banner ads thrown on top of, like scattered all over the bay, which is the department store downtown. Pretty much any available advertising space was used. And you can see here, companies that want to broadcast the games pay a lot of money too, and they actually in turn have to show the Olympic rings for, like, you know, during the year that they're actually broadcasting the Olympics. And in this case here, they actually don the Olympic rings right on the outside of the the station itself. And of course, every single advertisement space is bought. I could not even leave the transit system, doesn't matter how far away it is from the Olympics, without running across all the transit signs or all the transit ads being replaced with Olympic ads. So you can see here is a Visa ad on a bus stop there. But it doesn't mean that you can't advertise relating to the Olympics. Now, it's kind of weird how it works out, but in order to not get in trouble with the IOC or VANOC, you actually weren't allowed to advertise anything with 2010 Olympics or Vancouver, and I think winter was also part of it as well. So you couldn't make any mention of any of those four words if you're going to advertise anything that could be misconstrued as a part of the Olympics. So if you're going to sell flags, or you're going to sell sporting gear, or you're going to sell things like anything that, in general, that could somehow come back to be an Olympic thing, you could not put those words in there. So in this case here, Nike just decided to allow people to submit phrases to actually put on this projected wall here, which is not too far from where the bay was. This is actually next on the Sears downtown. And you could just basically submit a message, and it would be shown on the projector, as you can see here. Or you could be really creative and actually sell products that actually are sort of semi-branded as being Olympic, but they're not. So in this case here, Lululemon Athletica basically decided to sell all of these clothes that were colored in the colors of participating Olympic teams. So you can see here is Sweden, and this woman here is donning a painted black tooth, which for some reason is supposed to be attractive. And basically, you know, all it would have is like Sweden, Canada, United States, and their colors on there. But they didn't make mention of any of those words. So nothing about winter, Vancouver 2010, or the Olympics. Lululemon, I kept this on the market for about, I might be wrong, but I think it was no more than a week. And there was a lot of heat generated towards them. And eventually they buckled down after spending all this money, wasted all this, you know, all this material making this Olympic gear, or sorry, quote unquote Olympic gear. And, you know, they stopped selling it after all this pressure from the IOC. So you could try and get away with it, but usually, you know, the IOC and VANOC will, or sorry, and the Olympic Committee for that particular country will actually clamp down hard on you. Because, like, say later on, if Lululemon decided they wanted to be the official Olympic supplier for, I don't know, 2016 or whatever Olympics are coming up, they may not be able to do it because they screwed around and won the Olympics. So Stephen Colbert, if you ever can go back to an episode, made a good point about this. I actually got to see him live, so it was actually pretty hilarious. But this bit here was pretty straightforward. If you ever watched this bit, all he was doing is talking about what can I do if I'm going to talk about the Olympics. And he goes through this whole process explaining that he can't use the Olympic rings, he can't make any reference to the Olympic rings, he can't change the shape of the Olympic rings. And in this case here, you can't have the colors donning the Olympic colors in some sort of flat line going on two rows. So it's really silly in terms of how the copyright works out, but this is what he did. So he ended up coming up with like what quadrennial cold weather athletic competition or something like that is when he would refer to it as. And it was just, mind you, it wasn't really winter. It was more spring, actually, during the Olympics this year. But it's just to give you an idea of the absurdity of the whole copyright aspect of the Olympics. And Stephen Colbert was pretty bang on about it. And it's kind of sad, though, because with the Olympics comes a lot of problems. Like, in this case here, when they do come to town, they do get rid of anything graffiti-like. And this was not graffiti-like. This was actually an art project. The city of Vancouver actually tried to get rid of this art project and eventually backed down on it. But all it was just something that had been up for quite a while. But they thought it was graffiti because it was painted on a a plywood board over a window. But really, it was actually put there as an art piece. They actually did win on one thing. Apparently one night somebody plastered blue paint all over an existing mural. It was a nice mural with that. And then, of course, of all the controversy that came out, they put a new sign up that says, "New mural coming soon." And then that has been like that since then. So it's kind of awful. But try as you must to protect the Olympic try to protect the Olympic brand, it doesn't always work. So Pedo Bear apparently became a part of the Olympic brand. And what I'm telling you is quite true. He did become a part of the Olympic brand inadvertently because he was featured in a Polish newspaper. So I don't know how this came to be exactly, but my assumption, like everyone else, is pretty much they went on Google Image Search, did Vancouver 2010 mascots, and that came up. And I said, sure. Mind you, they hated us later on when it was actually Serbian, I think, actually, that had that accident. But some Eastern European country had that poor guy who actually crashed. But nonetheless, jokes on us. So I'm going to talk about tickets here. Tickets for the Olympics were, how can I put it? This is where my question about where this $1 billion in security went, because I actually thought that these tickets were insecure. There was nothing redeeming about them in terms of security. I don't know if any of you have ever seen the 25C3 talk on barcodes before, but I'm probably going to tell you everything you learned about barcodes there applies to the Olympics in Vancouver. So these were your typical tickets you would get, minus the data. Here's your actual standard set right here. That's it. You can actually, there's no real security on it. There's no water prints. Water marks, excuse me. And the only thing that authenticates, quote unquote, that it's an official Olympic ticket is the little hologram on the bottom right there. Or you end up buying one of these tickets here, which is, don't know that the hologram is there, which is what I ended up buying that actually has nothing. You can see here, this is a standard scan ticket. There's no watermarks. This is pretty much an exact photocopy of the tickets that I bought, except for the hologram there, which doesn't copy over. But I'm going to explain in a moment here why that hologram was stupid. And there's the back, nothing on the back there. Or you can have an Olympic pass, once again, has no security, except for a little perforation that goes down the bottom that anyone with a needle and a bit of time could replicate. My friend was nice enough to actually scan his in. You can see here, no security, no security, no security. So how do you copy a pass? Well, thanks to high-definition television, it's not that hard. You can pretty much just watch TV and wait for the pass to come along. And you can become part of the Olympic speed skating team in this case here. Really, it is that easy. I remember a couple instances watching a couple of matches, and you would just see this pass. And in one case, I was able to read the text on the bottom. But if you go back, you know, all you have to do is just, you know, come up with some bullshit name like, you know, cleaning services, which was real. Or you could just say, like, janitor or something like that. And all that mattered was that it looked real. Now, you're probably going to be wondering, well, what do you do about the little hologram there? Well, that's where it kind of got silly. And I'll actually talk about this in a sec here. Actually, I'll bring this up here, because somebody did actually manage to duplicate a pass. Now, this is, from my understanding, not the pass, but this is the pass that supposedly the media was told about, which was somebody printed a pass from Yahoo Canada that said all access and managed to get within 10 meters of Vice President Joe Biden. there was somebody who surprisingly is a huge fan enough of Joe Biden that he had to meet him. And he came in within 10 meters after getting through all the security checks. So this is really our $1 billion in security in action. And, you know, got 10 meters away from them. I don't know what 10 meters is in yards. It's probably, what, 30 yards? So that's fair. That's pretty... Okay, so 10 yards, 10 meters, you know, that's ballpark right there. So he got pretty freaking close to your guys' vice president. And so all he used was supposedly a pass like this. But the thing is, though, secrets don't stay secrets for a while. And a lot of the people who worked in BC Place when the opening ceremonies were going on and when this incident happened, all they heard was that, no, it wasn't that pass. It was actually a copied staff pass that had a barcode stolen from a Visa card. So that pretty much answered my question when I heard about this. Did they actually care about the barcode? Which really, the only time they cared about the barcode is when you entered into the Olympic Stadium. Or, sorry, into an Olympic event. Now, I'm going to go back and explain why those tickets were stupid in the first place in a moment here. But even if you didn't grab the hologram from the Royal Bank Visa card here, you could just as well go buy something from the Olympic, from anywhere that sells Olympic merchandise and just... you know, little blow dryer, pull off the sticker off the label that came with your Quachi there. So this is where it comes down to, can you copy a pass? And the answer is yes, you could have done that. There was no RFID. So that was the first thing that we thought of when we decided to actually play around with these tickets. The barcodes really don't have anything security because there's security and barcodes are don't go in hand in hand. And there was no real watermarks on them either. So I'll go back there for a sec. So what was the other problem with the tickets? Well, I'm going to talk about the ticket sale system. Now, I don't have any slides for it, but in BC, it is actually, and most of Canada, it's illegal to scalp tickets. But there's a way to get around it. You get a license to sell tickets, resell tickets. Now, in the past, the Vancouver Canucks tried to lock down ticket scalping, and all they ever accomplished was everyone got themselves licensed. So prior to that, everyone was hanging around the street selling their hockey tickets for, you know, $300, $400, you know, instead of $70, what they paid for the tickets. So when they tried to crack down, everyone said, oh, screw it, we'll just legitimize ourselves and we'll just get a license to sell these tickets. And now there's multiple companies in Vancouver that actually sell tickets, resell tickets after they've been bought. So VanOck, knowing that this would be a problem, and I'm surprised they didn't try to get a law passed for it, but decided that they would create their own ticket sales system. So if you bought a ticket for, you know, curling or hockey or something like that, and say you couldn't make it, well, you could just go and sell your ticket through the VanOck accredited ticket sales site. Now, the problem with that is that you would sell the ticket. But if you were one of those people who went and got those fancy tickets, which I showed a little bit earlier, which had a little nice little art on and so forth, you actually got to keep that ticket, even if you sell the ticket online, because then it would just go to the ticket vendor and actually just get a ticket printed out. It was a souvenir for you. Now, the problem with that is that you could just go and resell that ticket too. So you would make money off the first ticket. So whoever was nice, you went and bought the ticket, you know, VanOck would take, you know, 15% or whatever the hell they charged. And that person would be able to go to the game for whatever they paid for. But then you'd still have that physical ticket. So you could either A, go scalp it on the outside and risk getting arrested, or B, you can just go on Craigslist and just go sell your tickets that way. And this actually happened to several people. They actually went and bought these tickets through Craigslist and found that they were deactivated because somebody had already sold the tickets prior to. So, yeah, you can make twice as much money back on those tickets just because VanOck didn't think this whole system through. And if you wanted to, and going back to the whole Olympic, you know, pretending to be Olympic staff, it's actually not that hard. If you can see here, this ocean blue kind of jacket and the red gloves were actually readily available at pretty much any the Bay or Zeller's department store. So if you had that pass and you had the jacket and you had those gloves, which everyone in the country seemed to have during that time, you probably could have just gone away with it. I don't know about the lanyard, but the jacket definitely. So the last part here, I'm actually surprised I'm actually going much faster. Oh, wow. Okay. So the last part of this is all about the CCTV camera network. And this pretty much this had a lot of us in Vancouver who were interested in security and privacy pretty bothered. This one kind of amusing. CTV was the official broadcaster of the Olympics, and I actually happen to like this logo that somebody found there. But throughout Vancouver, they had several cameras set up, basically just to watch every move that every person visiting the games made. And a excuse me here, I'm going to skip ahead here. You can see another camera here. Actually, I'll go back. So an entire security camera system was set up throughout all the sites in Vancouver. Now, there was something like, how many people did I say there was? Sorry, so normally there's about 900 to 1,200 cameras in the downtown core. When the Olympics came in, they added an extra 2,000 cameras just to all the Olympic events. And that's quite a number when you think about the size and the space that they all take. And the system was adopted was something called Omnicast, which was from a Quebec firm called Genetech, which is a really stupid name. And this is the sort of diagram that they gave out with it. So it's a pretty simple IP camera system. But it's rather interesting because it can actually be integrated with something called AutoView, which is some sort of license plate reader, or a Synergist, which is another IP-based system, which allows you to do elevator control, access control, that sort of thing. So it was like one whole integrated system. So when I first heard of this system and started reading into it, I kind of wondered if this was going to be a permanent thing, because if they took these cameras and integrated it with the AutoView system, then, of course, they can keep track of your movements through license plates and so forth. So it was kind of interesting in that respect that they were adopting this system. And as you can see here, this is the whole map that was actually, those were the cameras prior to the Olympics, so that's, I'm not sure why that slide was in there in that order, excuse me. But this is the thing that kind of got us interested. So we figured out it was, you know, your standard camera setup, you know, MPEG-4, H.264, that sort of thing. And it was, you know, had IP and analog camera support. And that was okay, you know, it was your standard IP camera. But then we came across the transmission methods and discovered, oh, it could be doing it over wireless. So we got really excited over this. We're thinking here, okay, great, you know, these guys are really stupid. How could you implement a system that, you know, permits, you know, wireless cameras, right? And, you know, we decided, okay, three of us decided that we were going to go ahead and do this. We were just going to go and see if we can sniff out these cameras, right? Because if they're wireless, then theoretically we could view them, right? So we decided to go for a walk. So we walked from one point of the downtown core to what is known as Canby Street Bridge, which actually basically covered where the hockey games were held, and then where the Russian pavilion was, and along where the Olympic Village is. So the Olympic Village is on the left side of the screen, as you can see along this little route here. And, you know, we probably should have thought this through before we did this, but when you're in a highly densified area, you know, trying to track down wireless networks is, a specific wireless network is a pain in the ass. When we actually finished the job, when we walked from there to there, we found out there was about almost a gig of data. And, you know, it was painfully hard to sort through it. Now, I got to backtrack a little bit here, just back up a little bit here. And before I say anything here, I can't mention what we found when we walked through it, because how Canadian radio laws work, and I'm not a lawyer, so I might be getting this understanding wrong, is we can listen in, but we can't tell you the contents of what we found as we walked along. So I can't tell you what we saw happening along the route or anything like that. But what I can tell you is we didn't find anything. Now, which is kind of sad, but I can tell you we didn't find anything. So as you can see here, these were the areas we targeted. And as you can see here, the little red area down there was actually closed a couple days shortly after we had done that little job there. So it gives you a little bit of an idea of what the sort of area we were working with and what was happening. But, you know, we took for a walk and it warned us that the seawall was about to close. I think it was a few days after New Year's, so most of us had recovered from heavy drinking the few days before and were willing to do this walk. We went and took a look at the cameras, you know, their standard, you know, your standard fixed cameras and your standard dynamic movement cameras. And then we, you know, saw the little boxes there. And if you look towards the bottom, the little yellow thing there, if I'm not mistaken, is actually a power outlet. So, you know, we were kind of dismayed. You know, the power is probably not running to them. You know, we can't do anything with this. There's nothing broadcasting. You know, we did see the lines being run all over the place. We didn't know if they were Ethernet or if they're fiber or what. So we were rather disappointed to find out. We did find out, though, that this little unit on the top is actually a giant IR light emitter. We were trying to figure out, you know, we thought it might have been some sort of radar system to cut on bandwidth because they were using wireless, but in the end we figured it was actually some sort of giant IR flashlight, so to speak. But one of the guys, one of us actually took a walk to work one morning and found them setting up a camera. And lo and behold, it was actually Ethernet. So basically all they did to run this whole network was just make one giant Ethernet network. It was just nothing special about it. And yeah, we tried again to the CCTV network, or at least get an understanding of it. In the end, it turned out to be nothing fancy, which is kind of disappointing. But yeah, pretty much that's my whole little overview of it. I hope that from this talk here that it kind of inspires people when they're in London or they're in Sochi. I doubt there's anyone here from Sochi here and who would be willing to risk that. Or if you're in Rio, I highly encourage you to just take a look at the systems that they've implemented, or even ask if they've actually implemented their systems properly and not in half-assed like they have during the Olympics. So you would think for $1 billion they would have done a better job. But yeah, and also thanks to everyone who's helped me. I had some people from certain organizations help out. Chris Shaw, for instance, he was pretty vocal about being anti-Olympic. I'm not anti-Olympic. I'm not pro-Olympic, just so you guys know. But yeah, I just hope that this kind of leads out with some sort of inspiration. So thank you. We want to ask a question? Okay.
So I just came from Canada, too. I was in Toronto, so I got to experience the whole G20 thing full force. And a lot of the things you mentioned, it struck a parallel with me because Toronto did it, but to the next level. Mm-hmm. We spent $10 billion on security.
10?
I think that was the number. No,
one. Because I was about to say,
I'm mixing it up now. But right, I was wondering if you've heard much about Brian Son and his arrest, because he was doing similar things in terms of mapping out the camera networks and.
Are you talking
pictures.
About the guy, that CISP guy, or
yeah?
I don't know much about him actually, to be honest with you. But when I found out that he was a CISP, and then somebody being a dick actually went and got his CISP suspended. Right. I wasn't very impressed over that, but I don't know much about him to say anything. But okay. I do have to say I'm rather impressed that Toronto spent $1 billion in 3 days, and we spent $1 billion over 3 weeks scattered over 2 months. So I guess Toronto's all about spending more. I don't know.
Yeah. Is it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'm actually from Richmond, B.C., and
cool.
I was there for the entire Olympics, even to the run-up. I was born and raised there. And like throughout, right after 2003 to when 2010 hit, there was just all this pandemonium in the media. And it was really the media more than it was the people. Like mm-hmm. my friends and family did not give a shit. Like I really did not know anyone who was afraid of Al-Qaeda or any terrorist organization coming into BC and starting stuff up. I can't say that for everyone, but the people I knew generally. But there was like a great pandemonium in the media decrying, oh God, we're not ready. And I've personally talked to like an RCMP officer and he said, yeah, I'm really scared about the Olympics, and like it went off without a hitch. Where do you feel that fear and anxiety came from the government, that you know there might have been something really large coming through? Because I did not see it. I didn't really understand where that was coming from our politicians, and it really didn't make sense to me.
I think the whole attitude really comes down to what's going on in this country, for instance, and I think it kind of reflects upon what most of the Western governments are doing these days, which is, you know, this whole, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And realistically, in the end, I think a lot of people have become conditioned to the idea that they should hunker down and they should like, put their heads in the sands and just pray that nothing bad goes on and let, you know, other companies who sell these security products to run amok and, you know, keep us from dying. But honestly, you know, the worst things ever happened during the Olympics is... Actually, no. The worst things ever happened during the Olympics is what happened in Atlanta 96, which is where a pipe bomb went off.
Munich.
Munich? Munich was... And that was before that. That's correct. They had the Israelis that were kidnapped, if I'm not mistaken. Am I correct with Munich? Yeah. So... But I really think most of the Olympic security paranoia has gotten worse since 96, but I think with 9/11 and all these other things have come along, the governments have decided, well, it's in our best interest just to go to the extreme, even though it's unnecessary.
Yeah, just one more quick question.
Yeah.
Do you think it should have been handled the same way if it was done all over again? Do you think, like, you would have done it the same way?
You know, it's funny. I think it would be, because it's like, if you look at Sochi, a lot of people think Sochi's unprepared, and there's a good chance it could come back to Vancouver. If it were to come back to Vancouver or come back to North America, which it might, actually I would expect it to, I would think that same level of paranoia would come back. Whether or not they'll spend as much money or if they'll spend more, I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Looks like you're getting all the Canadians asking questions. The first fellow mentioned the G20 and the G8 in Toronto recently, and the point's been made that a similar cost for security was spent on both that and the Olympics. But at least in the case of Vancouver, they got the potential economic benefits of being on the Today Show, being on the Stephen Colbert and that. So I wonder if you could give us your thoughts on that. And also with regard to the black bloc tactics that you mentioned, that happened on the first day in Vancouver. And of course, we saw in Toronto police cars being torched. But prior to the Olympics, the head of Olympic security was asked if he would rule out the possibility of using the agent provocateur tactic.
And Mr. Bud Mercer,
he would not rule that out. And it seems that we always see these people in black hoods, and we never find out who they are, but in the media it's reported that protesters torched police cars. And it's kind of, it reminds me of when, you know, some company allows their security to be breached. It's reported as hackers, you know, penetrated security when they don't know who penetrated their security. Mm-hmm. So I just sort of wondered about your thoughts on that as well with regard to the black bloc tactics.
Well, the black bloc tactics, speaking as a former history major, I don't really find their tactics as really weird. It's not unusual to see this sort of thing. Whether or not I agree with them, it's kind of a, you know, give or take sort of situation. I don't know how to address it, really, give you a proper answer without going into a whole diatribe.
I'm just wondering if you feel that that was, in fact, people that were protesting, or if it was possibly...
I'm gonna go 50-50 on that. Like, yeah. I think it's very likely you did actually have that sort of element, but at the same time, I can't give you that answer either, right? So...
And what about contrasting Vancouver's security expenses?
Oh, I would say that it was better value for the money. Even I don't know whether or not the Olympics will spin off anything good for the city, but whether or not it was better to spend it in Vancouver over Toronto, I'd say Vancouver definitely. At least it was for the people and not for 40 random old guys who I don't give a damn about.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if. If the Vancouver city environment was restored to its initial state, were all the cameras taken down? Were all of the security mechanisms taken down? Or,
well, fortunately, all the walls disappeared, so that was a good thing. But with regards to the cameras, the Vancouver police wanted to keep them, and they were really pushing for it. Fortunately, this current city council seems to have some sort of semblance of intelligence, even though it's kind of debatable. And they just voted against, they voted to keep the cameras but not keep them fixed. So basically what they meant is they have the cameras still, but they're not in place. And they only bring them out apparently when there's special events going on. I kind of take that view as they want to just keep it around and eventually reconsider implementing them, because there's always been that talk about putting cameras in the downtown core anyway. And it's a common topic that comes across the whole country to begin with. So... I'm hoping that the cameras go away and they don't come back, but like they could rear their ugly head again. So,
hi. I heard that there was a lot of trouble with the weather in the Olympics, and I was wondering, was there any interesting technology deployed to
dump trucks?
Yeah, just dump trucks
of snow. I kid you not. So they said they weren't lying when they said it was going to be the greenest Olympics, because there was plenty of green grass everywhere. If you saw in that first photo, when I was going through the curling curling over that green field there, that was the first ever spring Olympics. Now, they had a snow event. They actually canceled all these people from standing to actually watch the games, because there was just mud and snow all over the place. But what they did is they brought snow from a place called Manning Park, which is about 200, 300 kilometers away from Vancouver itself, and brought them all the way into the city, into one of the mountains north of the city, just so people could ski on them. So, yeah, they were the greenest Olympics ever, but they had a hell of a carbon footprint. So, so yeah, there's nothing else. Thank you very much.